Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of person can convince heads of state to speak candidly, can write knowledgeably on everyone from Jesus to Jack Ruby to John Wayne, and can earn the respect and friendship of men as different as Studs Terkel and William F. Buckley? Gary Wills is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and professor emeritus of history at Northwestern University. He has written more than 36 books and hundreds of magazine pieces. Now he has penned the story of his own relationship to reading, writing, and the men and women he has grown to know through his work. The new memoir by Gary Wills is called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer. Gary, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
This is as much an account of your love of reading as it is your career in writing. And you write that throughout your life, books have opened door after door for you, but most of the time you haven't chosen to go through them. Can you talk about that?
Well, I am by temperament an observer, and books, of course, put you at one remove from life. My father thought that was going to be a terrible thing for me. But actually, it made me useful to a lot of people. For instance, with Bill Buckley, he got into a lot of fights with his fellow Catholics, and he had had no Catholic schooling and was not much interested in reading long encyclicals and other papal documents. I loved to do that, so I would kind of prep him on those things off and on. And so I often found that I could serve. Well, for instance, when I was in Dallas, writing about Ruby, Bill Willis was the drummer in the Carousel Club, Ruby's Carousel Club, and he was an autodidact and a very intelligent, interesting guy who wrote plays on the side. And when he found out that I had read a lot of plays, that was an instant bond, and through him I could meet the other members of the Carousel veterans group of strippers and musicians and bouncers and people like that.
That must have been a really surreal time in your career. This was a couple of years after Jack Ruby had been incarcerated. Is that right?
Yeah, he was dying, although he didn't know that when we went there. Harold Hayes had this idea that he would put me in odd situations, odd for me, so that I could observe them. Other editors at Esquire said when I started writing for them, oh, you've got to move to New York or Washington to be where things are. And Harold said, no, I like the fact that he's a Midwestern guy who comes at it with a fresh eye and is not a New York know-it-all. So once again, being at one remove helped me out. So he sent me to interview Ruby, but we couldn't get to him because he was dying. He sent Ovid Damaris to kind of open the way for me because he had written about Dallas in the past and knew a lot of the people involved in the police and prosecutorial side of the city. So the two of us went around to the strip joints, Barney Weinstein's, which had taken over the people from Carousel, and talked to a lot of the kind of low life that Ruby dealt with and the high life of the Dallas elite.
Were the low-life types that you talked to try and understand this man, were they like Ruby, who had so loved any kind of publicity or being able to say that he had rubbed shoulders with people with any kind of power?
Well, some of the people who pretended to know him and testified to the Warren Commission were that sort. They were publicity seekers. The performers in the club, of course, wanted publicity for their act, but they were rather shy off stage. They were, most of them, mothers who had to bring up their children, and wives who had marital problems. So a lot of their life was kind of in the shadows. It's interesting that Bill Willis was hired, among other things, to be a bouncer because he was Mr. Texas at one time, a bodybuilder type, and a gymnastics trainer. And he said he would hardly ever have a chance to bounce anybody because by the time he got off the stage, Jack had already thrown the person's troublemaker out. He was on a flash fire fuse. And said a stripper would come in beaten up with a broken nose or something, and Ruby knew that her husband had been mistreating her, and the next time her husband showed up, Jack would go over and punch him out. So that was the way Jack was.
Did you conclude that there was any evidence whatsoever that Ruby had been part of some odd conspiracy?
Absolutely none. Yeah. And the people who claimed that made up so patently false accusations that it took just a simple reading of the Warren Commission report to find that these were all made up. I knew some of the people who were testifying. I knew Revelo Oliver, for instance, who thought it was all a communist conspiracy. And I knew he was a madman. But, you know, people, the conspiratorialists fish in those three dozen volumes, and they come across something like Revelo claiming to know things. And he was a very learned person. He was a classics professor, which is how I knew him. And the Warren Commission didn't bother to track down all these false stories and try to disprove them all. They would still be at it this minute. But it was clear from the context that most of it was made up. And so Mark Lane, in his book, takes the testimony of one woman and doesn't mention the fact that she appeared two other times under two different names, you know, and told different stories. And so I found out from her husband that Lane knew that she was mentally disturbed, and she was actually in a home when I called, and never reported that. So there's so much dishonesty in the conspiratorialists.
So it's essentially a selective reading of the Warren Commission report and other evidence.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Ruby himself was so unpredictable and volatile and on the surface candid that to think of him as a conspirator is absolutely impossible. My partner there, Ovid Damaris, was in the police garage when Ruby came in and shot Oswald. And he had been waiting around for hours. Everybody was. Nobody knew when Oswald was going to be brought out. They were questioning him, and they gave no time. And Ruby had run some ordinary errands before, and he just came in at that moment. He often hung around the police station. And he always had a gun because he carried a lot of cash from the club. And the way he would punch out the husband when he showed up, he shot Oswald. It's as simple as that.
You have written so many books and articles over the year, and this is in addition to teaching full-time or part-time throughout most of that career. How do you decide what you want to write about next?
Well, partly it's a matter of what editors want. Partly it's a matter of agents wanting something. Some of it I do kind of on my own hook. But for the most part, I have to get an advance from a publisher, so I have to present an idea that they're interested in. And I have to turn down a lot of ideas. For instance, I've written on a couple of presidents. Once you do that, editors and agents want you to write about every president who comes down the line. So I've been asked to write about Ford and first Bush and second Bush and Carter and Clinton. And I said no. You know, once I had done the presidents that I thought were kind of the lightning rods that revealed a lot about the nation, Reagan or Kennedy, I didn't want to keep just going around that same track. A lot of it, the variety in what I do is that I don't want to get bored. I was well known here at Northwestern for not teaching the same course more than once because I felt I went stale if I just repeated anything. So I was constantly making up new courses, which meant that I was constantly looking at new ideas for books, too.
So you could never get too comfortable with one subject area.
That's right.
What do you find, having interviewed and spoken with so many presidents, is there anything they have in common besides this power that must change you?
Oh, dear. I think they're mainly different. You know, who could be more different than, say, Carter and Reagan?
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of the same pressures on them, of course, and they have a lot of the insulations from certain kind of criticism or reality that puts them in what's now being called the bubble. They all have that. Mainly what's common among them is not the fact that they're presidents, but that they're politicians. I find that politicians in general thrive on constant interpersonal contact. They don't feel fully alive unless they're talking to people, which means that if they ever had the habit of reading, they lose it very fast. Some didn't. Carter didn't. But, of course, he was more reclusive than most politicians. Dukakis didn't, but he was a failed politician. But most politicians I find, even, well, George McGovern, I knew him well, and he had been at my university. He went to Northwestern and got a doctorate in history and taught history for a while. So after he lost the presidency, the dean of the school here, who knew I knew him, said, do you think he could teach a good course here? And I said, sure. He knows the ropes. He's been in the academy. And so he was signed up to teach a course here, and vast enrollment of students, teaching assistants and droves to do the discussion groups and the grading. And he came in and told campaign stories and war stories and Washington stories. And when he ran out of his stock of stories, he didn't know where to go. And the students started streaming out of the classroom. So, you know, even somebody who starts out with a scholarly bent can hardly keep it in the daily pressure of a politician. You know, they're on the run all the time, dinners and phone calls to raise money and this cause and that cause. So they lead a very distracted life, and it becomes, in most cases, a somewhat shallow life.
You know, it's funny, there's nothing about that schedule or that constant time at the center of attention that sounds appealing to me at all.
No, but they live on it, and they can't give it up. That's why they keep running for president, you know. Once you run for president, you're doomed to do it ever after, because that was the highlight of their life. Everywhere they went, everybody was screaming how much they loved him. They had people working their hearts out for him, destroying their families in order to promote him. And that's just very heady. Graham Greene described that in one of his books. I forget which one now. But he had an ex-candidate for president who was always planning to run again.
It must be harder for someone who does this and achieves the presidency at a relatively young age to get past it afterward.
Yeah, although I must say, Carter and Clinton both are turning out to be very good ex-presidents, which is unusual. Most ex-presidents sit around and tend their archives or play golf. Or Harry Truman used to go and play the piano in his mock White House for anybody who would come by and pay attention to him.
Well, Clinton says everybody always likes you better after you're gone anyway.
Well, that's not entirely true. Nixon was not much liked after he was gone.
Gary Wills is my guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and professor emeritus of history at Northwestern University. His new memoir is called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and professor of history emeritus at Northwestern University, Gary Wills. His new memoir is called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer. You can join our conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Gary, going back to Richard Nixon, you profiled him when he was still a candidate for president and came away somewhat impressed. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes. I asked him a question, which I've asked a lot of people later on, a lot of politicians. What is the book that influenced them most? And most of the answers are kind of stock, expected, shallow. But with him, he gave it some real thought. We discussed several books, but the one he settled on as having the most influence on him was Claude Bowers' Life of Albert Beveridge, which came as a great surprise to me because Bowers was a Democrat friend of FDR, and Beveridge, though he was a Republican, was a great admirer of the Federalists, especially John Marshall, Chief Justice John Marshall, about whom he wrote a huge book. But as Nixon explained, Bowers had a kind of Wilsonian attitude toward America leading the democracies of the world, and Beveridge was a great believer in executive energy, and those were things that were very much on Nixon's mind. And he even talked to me this early in the 1968 campaign about what became the opening to China. He had obviously thought very long and hard about very difficult things and used resources that I would never have expected. You know, there were no votes in saying you're a Claude Bowers fan.
The book that you have reread most often in your life is Tolstoy's War and Peace. Why?
Well, it's just a gripping story with lots of interesting reflections on history, on the great man theory, on war. And luckily, there have been a number of good translations that have come out recently. I began with the old Constance Garnett one. And the newer ones, have much more local color and accurate description of Russian life and Russian activity. So I never get tired of it. I also love an 8-hour-long Bondarchuk movie of it, which is the best movie to be made from an historical novel, I think. It was made under Stalin and had all the resources of the Russian state, the whole army and everything thrown in. But it really captures a lot of the sweep of the novel.
Does going back to the same work in different iterations keep it from, allow you to continue discovering new things, or is there an element of almost ritual to returning to a work you know very well?
Well, I think it was Nabokov said, there's no such thing as reading, there's only rereading. That if you really find something that's rewarding, it will continue to be rewarding as you reread it. And, you know, especially that's true not only of novels, perhaps not particularly of novels, but of great historical works like The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, or works of theology and philosophy like St. Augustine's Confessions. I've read that. You know, I've read War and Peace more than any other novel, but I've read The Confessions of Augustine more than any other book, much, much more than any other book.
Does it mean different things to you as you move through different stages in your life?
Sure. You're a different person in some measure every time you read it. And you know more not only about yourself and your current world, but usually about the author, too. Because if you're interested in an author, you continue to pick up information about him and his other works. It helps to have read The City of God before or at the same time that you're reading Confessions. And the same is true, I think, with most people, that most authors. The more you know of that author, even when you read inferior works or minor works, the more light it throws on the important works. You can see, well, this is why he could pull it off in this case, because he couldn't quite do it there.
You also write about reading Greek, and you say that essentially it's just a phenomenal intellectual investment for anyone to make. What makes it so?
Well, if you're interested in history, there'll be constant references back to the methods of the earliest historians, Herodotus and Thucydides. If you're interested in politics, there'll be constant references to Aristotle, constitutionalism, divided government. If you're interested in philosophy, Plato's around every corner. If you're interested in drama, the great Greek tragedians and comedians founded the genre. If you're interested in lyric poetry, there's Sappho and Anacreon. The early novels were all by ancient Greeks. So all those realms have a constant reference back to the originals, and it's helpful to look at them in the original.
And is there something more stirring about reading the original language than a translation?
Sure. All translations are faulty. There's no such thing as a perfect translation because each word has a different history in a different language. They don't have the same background. They don't have the same penumbra, the same connections, the same suggestions. So that's why it's important to read a number of translations if you don't know the original, because chances are what one misses, the other might pick up, and that's cumulative across a bunch of them. So people who read, a dozen translations of a Sappho poem probably have a better chance of getting at what the original was than somebody who reads just one translation.
Gary, how does being such a careful and committed reader affect the way you think about the people who come to your writing?
What do you mean, who write about me?
Who read your work. Do you imagine that they give your work this kind of thought and that it sort of means as much in their lives as some of the works that you've read have meant to you?
Oh, I don't know. You know, Waugh and other people have kind of made fun of reviewers because it's an underpaid, overworked job. And the editor assigning the book to a particular reviewer often makes a mistake or doesn't exactly match them perfectly. So I don't expect people, a reviewer, to be a scholar, you know, to spend months studying me. They have to write fast to deadline, and sometimes they're great, sometimes they're not so great. But I'm not surprised. You know, I'm in that same line of work myself.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest this hour is Gary Wills. His new book is called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer. Let's go to Scott in Dallas. Hi, Scott.
Yes, I'm humbled now and almost embarrassed. I feel like I need to go back and start reading today.
In Greek.
Yes. My question was, since the professor is such an observer of history, if he can recall a time, it doesn't seem to me that we have been as vitriolic or as hateful in our partisanship as we have been the last few years. And I was a little too young to remember how they treated Eleanor Roosevelt, but I was just wondering if he had an opinion about, does he believe we're going to get worse or better as far as our discourse goes?
Well, I hope better. There have been really, really vile periods in our history. The early period, that was true of. The kinds of things that were written about Jefferson and Adams and John Quincy Adams, it was alleged that he had been a pimp for the Tsar when he was the ambassador to Russia. And this was broadly published and believed during his campaign for the presidency. And, of course, Jefferson was constantly attacked as an atheist and a believer in Satanism and a sexual pervert and all those things. So these things come in cycles. We've never been as bad as during the Civil War, of course, because country was divided. divided down to its roots. It became two countries. And the vituperation on both sides was, one of my heroes is Basil Gildersleeve, America's greatest classicist, Greek teacher at Johns Hopkins University. He was a Confederate soldier, and he wrote the most vicious things about Abraham Lincoln. You know, this wonderful scholar and kind of role model for me, that he could do that is always just astounding. People get carried away in historical periods of division. That was true of Watergate, and it's true right now, of course. I hope we'll come out of it as we came out of the same kind of thing in the past.
You have a photograph above your desk of the first mourner to pass Martin Luther King's coffin. Can you talk about its significance to you?
Yeah, I went down the minute I heard that Dr. King had been shot, and went to the Lorraine Motel where he was shot. And there are only a couple of journalists there, but Art Shea, the photographer for Life magazine, said, "Why don't we go see what's happening to the body?" So he had rented a car, and we went to the police station. And they said that he was being treated at the Lewis Funeral Home. So we went there, and there was only one journalist there when we got there, and only the three of us as we stayed through the night. And they were working. It was a converted white neighborhood mansion that had turned into a funeral home when the blacks moved in. And the big living room was the display room, and there was a thin partition between it and the workroom. And we could hear them working on his body and saying that his whole jaw had been shot away. They had to build a plaster jaw and fix it and powder it to match his skin. And at the same time, the radio was broadcasting his speeches. So his live voice was coming through that partition along with the talk over his dead body. When they brought the body out, there was a scrim over the casket. And this was 5 or so in the morning, and there was a thin line of mourners outside waiting to get in. And Art said, "I can't photograph through a scrim. You've got to take that off." And he said, "Well, I can't because our people are very emotional. They kiss and they touch and they hug and they'll brush the powder off the plaster jaw." But Art persuaded him, and the funeral director stood right there and directed a woman away when she tried to touch him. But anyway, the Art took a picture of the first ones as they came past the open casket, and he sent me a copy, and that's what hangs over my desk as I write.
Are you conscious at a moment like that when you are in the same room, essentially, this great hero of civil rights is being embalmed, that you are a witness to something important in history that only a few other people will ever know about, if not for your account of it?
Well, what I was thinking of at the time was, how do I get more information for my Esquire piece? Mm-hmm. So I did go over to the kind of flop house where the guy had stood to shoot him, and there was nobody around, no police or anything. So the owner took me up to his room. He shot from a bathroom, and he couldn't get high enough, to angle toward the motel balcony. So he had to stand in the bathtub, and I found that out by doing it, by realizing that's the only place he could have stood, that he would have had a clear shot. But that, you know, I'm not thinking of history. I'm thinking of Harold Hayes, my editor at Esquire, that he's going to be very happy to learn this.
And maybe it's good that you don't have the weight of history on your shoulders when you're trying to get out there and get a story reported.
No, and you don't know what else is going to be written. Other things are going to come along and follow up on yours. So, no, it's a matter of just trying to drink in as much information as possible, as fast as possible.
Can you talk about the night that you spent in jail with, I don't know if I have the complete list here, but it included Dr. Spock, Judy Collins, Joseph Papp, and Richard Avedon?
Yeah, there's a very interesting guy who kind of dragooned us all into this. I had been to a lot of demonstrations, and I had resolved not to join them, even when a friend of mine, Mary Kempton, did, and I was tempted but didn't.
These are, excuse me for interrupting, demonstrations against the Vietnam War.
Yeah, and finally said, you know, isn't it time you put your body where your mouth is? And I said, well, most of these demonstrations don't accomplish anything. And he said, this one could be different. We have congressional sponsorship. We're presenting a petition for redress of grievance under the Constitution that the Congress was funding an undeclared war, which it has no power to do. So we were going to, 100 of us or so, were going to block the chamber door while our representatives went in and presented the petition and not leave until they stopped funding the war. Well, of course, we got arrested and carted off. And I was in a cell with Carl Hess, the speechwriter for Barry Goldwater in his libertarian days. Now he was in his anarchist days. And he was a friend, and we talked about the Greek New Testament I had with me. And so then when I went back, we failed at the House. We decided to go do the same thing, block the Senate and tell them to declare war or to call the war off as an undeclared war. And Carl Hess came up to me and said, I hope we get in the same cell again tonight. I said, why? He said, because I've been studying Greek. I want to go over verb forms. So once again, my reading kind of opened up a new world for me. By the way, we didn't get into the same cell. We got separated at the fingerprinting stage.
Gary Wills is my guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and professor emeritus of history at Northwestern University. His new memoir is called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer. You can be part of this conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gary Wills. His new memoir is called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You alluded to the fact near the top of the hour that your parents, who were not college educated, never fully understood your love for reading. Have you ever spent much time wondering where you came from in terms of the way you see the world and the way you value words?
Well, I was very lucky to have wonderful teachers from the very outset. I had Dominican nuns teaching me in grade school, and they taught me so well that they got me ahead of my class. So in the war, when we had to move, when my father went into the army, back to a different town, Albion, there was no Catholic school there. So I had, for 1 year, I had public school education. But the teacher there, Miss Bifus, said, you're not getting anything out of class because the nuns had equipped me so well. So why don't you just go into the library and read? And she allowed me to do that whole year. I'm sure you couldn't get away with that now in a public school. But from there, I went back to the nuns, who were very good, and they said I should skip a grade because I now read myself ahead of even where I was. And when my mother said, no, that's not a good idea to get him out of his own age group, they said, well, send him to a difficult school then, to a Jesuit school. And my favorite nun there had a Jesuit brother, and she recommended that school, and I went there. And those were wonderful teachers, just great teachers. That's where I first studied Latin and Greek and music and drama. And most of the things that I've been interested in all my life, began there in that high school.
And you still say the rosary every day?
Yes.
Do you see that as a ritual of, is it worship, is it comfort, is it kind of meditation?
Well, it's a prayer. It's the one of the earliest prayers I learned, and I don't have a lot of forms of prayer that I can jettison them. But yes, it is a form of meditation, and it's a meditation on the Gospels, so that means that I have to advert to 20 different episodes in the Gospels on a rotating basis, which is a very good way to remind myself that I'm a Christian. But as I say, it is also a time of quiet, of meditation and calm. People have various forms of that. It's recommended as a kind of healthful exercise. So I think the rosary does all of those things for me.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who writes, presumably you're familiar with the arguments used by Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins whenever they debate someone over religion. What would be your counter-arguments to either of those gentlemen?
Well, those are kind of fruitless efforts, it seems to me, because there are different kinds of knowledge, scientific knowledge and poetic knowledge and human knowledge, and religion involves all of them, not just some of them. My lodestone is St. Augustine, who said, we don't go outside ourselves to find God. We can only find him by going inside ourselves. Man is the image of God, the closest thing to God there is on earth. And he says, I was looking for you, God, outside, and all the time you were waiting for me inside. And he said, by contemplating his own complexity and simplicity, he said, after all, we think, we will, we remember, we have these different functions, and there's a difference in us as we're doing that, and yet we all feel that we're one, that that's the same person doing the different things. And that's the image he has of the divine Trinity, that there are three persons in God, because it's not good for God to be alone. And the closest we can come to inspecting that mystery, and it is a mystery, there's not an exact parallel, is the marvel of the human soul.
Does that account of Augustine's initially looking to the outside for God, does that play into the title of your book, Outside Looking In?
My God, I never even thought of that. Of course, he doesn't think he's outside looking in. He thinks he's inside looking in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not quite parallel.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Jeffrey in Rowlett. Hey, Jeffrey.
Good afternoon, Chris. Enjoy listening to your program a great deal.
Thanks.
Professor Wills, I had the pleasure of reading your book, Certain Trumpets, which is about leadership and the nature of leadership, more particularly the different kinds. I was wondering if you would care to comment on the nature of leadership that you see today in the United States or even elsewhere around the world.
Well, the great leaders, Mandela, Mother Teresa, are the saints, of course, and I talk about that in the book. But we don't normally run across that. There are not that many saints around, and certainly not in public life. But there are some wonderful leaders around. I was always disappointed that Mario Cuomo didn't go farther. I thought he had great leadership skills that should have been deployed on a broader range of options than the state of New York. Jesse Jackson is a wonderful leader. He was cut off from his ability to go higher because a black couldn't go higher at that point. He was blazing the way for Obama. But I think Hillary Clinton is proving to be a pretty good leader right now, too.
Do you think she has presidential qualities?
Sure. I think she does.
Including that pervasive desire for human interaction?
Yeah, yeah. She has that. I think she's a little more reflective than some. But I didn't get the impression that she was a great reader now. She used to be. When I asked her what book influenced her most, she answered instantly. Most of them grope around and try to think of something that will impress you or or try to remember whether they have read a book. But with her, it came instantly. She said, The Brothers Karamazov. And I said, why? And she said, I read it in high school, and it opened up a whole new view of spirituality that I had never had. Now, that's a thoughtful person.
I think my favorite chapter in the book is the one that you write about your wife, Natalie, especially because it sounds as if 50 years after the day you met her, she delights you every bit as much as she ever did. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Well, that's like talking about the air I breathe. it's always there, and thank God it is. She came over to me on an airplane. She was a flight attendant and said, you're too young to be reading that book. So that started a conversation, which continued while she drove me to a party that night. And then when we got back together that weekend, it continued through that. And then it has continued through a lifetime.
And it struck you at the time that most flight attendants wouldn't have even recognized the book that you were reading.
Well, I wouldn't have said that. That would be snobbish. You know, I don't have the bigoted idea of what a flight attendant is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about this. Do you think that outsider status is something that you have chosen for yourself, or is that just the way you're wired?
It's probably temperamental. As I say, I was a bookworm from the outset, and when I was in high school, I would go to basketball games because it was expected of us, but I would read through the whole game, and I read just constantly. I used to read when I walked because I wanted to get out of the house. My parents were chain smokers, and I hated the smell of smoke, so I kind of found a way to read almost every waking moment and long into the night. So obviously that did temperamentally establish my life rhythms.
You read so much that your father bribed you to try to spend a week without your nose in a book.
Yeah, it bothered him that he read so much. He couldn't understand that. He was a very active person himself, and kind of like those politicians I've talked about. He wanted interaction. He always wanted to bet me to hunt something and, you know, have me engage, play cards. Or he always wanted to teach me how to play golf, and I hated the idea because it's such a waste of time. And when I caddied for him, I would carry a book in the bag, and when we were held up by people ahead of us, I would pull it out and read it. So finally he said to me, if you will not read a single thing for a whole week, I'll give you, I guess it was $5. And so I took the bet and got the $5 and bought a book.
Did your differences from one another disappoint you both?
I'm sure it did. He wanted me to be a great athlete, as he had been. I wanted him to be a faithful husband, as my mother did, and he wasn't. We had some disappointments. On the other hand, he was fun. He was fun to be around, and he was remarkably generous. My grandmother just adored him because when he was courting my mother, every time he would visit her mother, my great-grandmother, Mian, was crippled and couldn't come away from the second floor of the flat they lived in. Every time my father went there, he would pick my great-grandmother up, take her down, put her in the car, and take her to a movie or a bingo game or a park. And, of course, that endeared him to my grandmother. And then when my grandmother and her family were trapped in the Louisville flood. The minute he heard that, my father, who was in Michigan, rented an outboard motor, hitched it to the back of his car, drove to the edge of the flood, and took the boat in, picked up the great-grandmother and two daughters, put them in the boat as much as it would carry, and took them to safety, then went back and got my grandmother and grandfather and took them to safety. That's the kind of thing that he could do that would really win hearts.
Gary, nobody, even you, can read everything there is out there that's worth reading. Do you ever feel, does it stress you out thinking there may be something wonderful that you're missing?
Oh, absolutely. Sure, true. I mean, I know of a lot of books that I will never get time to read. But it's fun to just keep reading the ones I'm reading.
Who or what influences what you go to next? Is it all about what you're interested in and you find it yourself, or are there people that who's...
Well, I normally have projects that I'm working on. Shakespeare, I've done two things on him, and I'm doing another one now, a series of lectures at Bard College. I am interested in the whole late antique period of St. Augustine, so now I'm doing a book on Ambrose, the man who baptized him and who was the kind of the ruler of the city of Milan when he was the bishop there, most powerful figure in the West. So that's an interesting subject, and I'll be going to Milan in a week.
Oh, that's fun.
To pursue that.
Is it? Do you always like to try to be physically in the place that is the center of whatever you're writing about?
Yeah, that's fun. When I was working on Jefferson, I went to all of the mansions, the estates that existed in his Virginia, and frequently back to several. When I was writing my book on Gettysburg, I went and stayed there in a motel while I wrote it. And I visited, I took my children there. So sure, it's great fun to do that.
Is it harder to write about yourself than anybody else?
I try not to. You know, this book's really about the people I've met.
Yeah.
Beverly Sills and Studs Terkel and that kind of thing.
Gary Wills has been my guest this hour. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and professor emeritus of history at Northwestern University. His new memoir is called Outside Looking In, Adventures of an Observer. Gary, it's been a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
It was fun.
Gary, my name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.